Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune, KCPW, and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, filling in as a guest host today on the program. Today on the show, a local coalition launches a formal bid to bring Major League Baseball to Salt Lake City, and leaders hope to use that idea as a springboard for reimagining a big piece of the city's west side. An investigation shows that Utah's secretive medical malpractice panels make it harder to sue healthcare workers, and the scientific and not-so-scientific reasons behind this year's whale of a snow season. We might try to squeeze in some other stories in this show as well, but joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Jessica Miller, who is investigative reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Jessica, thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know what? Say that again.
Good morning.
There we go. Thanks very much. I'm relearning the ropes here. Also, joining us on the Zoom, we've got Tony Semerad, who is real estate reporter with the Tribune. And Tony, thanks for being here as well. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And George Pyle, opinion editor with the Tribune, is with us. And welcome, George. What a pleasure.
Good morning.
Good morning. And later in the show, we are going to hear from Utah Jazz beat writer and, special weather correspondent, Andy Larson. That's not his official title, but he'll just have to deal with it on the reasons behind our big snow winter. Listeners, if you'd
data
like to join... data columnist. Thank you, George. Listeners, you can join this conversation by tweeting your comments to @KCPW today if you'd like to participate. And this show is going to end with sports, so let's start with sports as well. Tony Semerad, this is actually more than a sports story, as many sports stories are. This is the fact that that Salt Lake City and the state of Utah want to bring Major League Baseball to town. What is the vision here, and who is behind it?
Well, as of a couple of days ago, yes, the city has thrown its proverbial hat into the ring to recruit a Major League Baseball franchise in the coming years. This is being driven primarily by the longtime Jazz owner, Gail Miller, although there is a very impressive consortium of business and community and elected officials and sports and entertainment celebrities that are also behind this. It's being called Big League Utah, and right. This consortium will pull together the financial and lobbying resources, if you will, to sort of press the MLB along with a number of other cities to be an expansion city. The league is talking about expanding from 30 to 32 teams over the next couple of years, or is at least expressed that desire, and it's probably going to take longer than a couple of years. And so we're now in the game.
Okay, we're bidding. We're basically trying to be one of the teams that gets one of those two expansion one of the cities that gets one of those two expansion slots. This is a weird question, Tony, to just jump right into, but National League or American League? Maybe it doesn't really matter anymore.
Well, I don't know if the MLB has actually decided. I think it's going to be one team in the East and one in the West. But again, those seem to be that seems to be a very tentatively expressed desire at this point. They're focused on figuring out the futures of a couple of existing teams right now before they proceed with that expansion.
Got it.
But yeah, there's one proposed out here, and there's one proposed back East.
I mentioned the real estate aspect of the story that you covered. This is meant to go. You know, maybe I'll just start with the fact that I've seen the renderings in the Salt Lake Tribune of what this the field looks like, what the vision is, and where it's going to go. Maybe you can fill us in on that. These renderings have these smokestacks in them because it's at the old Gadsby power plant, and the smokestacks are actually kind of symbols of what this coalition wants to create, because this is the power district in Salt Lake City. What is the power district, and how would this stadium conceivably fit into it?
Well, most long-term residents will be familiar with that a generally kind of open stretch of property along North Temple that has been Rocky Mountain Power's main operational site since the 1940s, and the Gadsby plant is located there, and that's why the stacks are there. It's about 100 acres, and what's so interesting is there appears to have been a sort of a convergence in timing with this MLB bid and Rocky Mountain Power's goals for developing that site. It envisions retiring the Gadsby plant tentatively around 2030 and has already been exploring redeveloping certain portions of the site in to build a new headquarters and a new operational center and a parking garage, and have been negotiating with the city on some zoning changes to kind of make that possible right there along that stretch where kind of North Temple meets the Jordan River. And, you know, there this redevelopment had been in the works for a number of years, but it has now, again, through this sort of timing convergence, it's now emerged as the prime location, the most likely location for a new MLB stadium.
Tony, I've seen some hilarious photoshops out there, you know, around on the internet that have the rendering, but then show just basically nothing but smokestacks in the background. The plan, though, really is to kind of keep them there as a nod to what this district has been. Is there going to be smoke coming out of these smokestacks at the old power plant if all of this redevelopment happens?
No, I think by that time the plant would probably be retired. But you're exactly right. Rocky Mountain Power says that it has done kind of regional surveys, and there's a lot of sentimental attachment, if you will, to those stacks in the community. And Rocky Mountain Power also kind of sees that as part of what it's calling its industrial heritage. So yes, we've seen these renderings of what the view from the proposed stadium might look like, and there the stacks are right up against the Wasatch. You know, it's so far down the road. I think it might be a little iffy to kind of predict what the fate of those smokestacks will be. I know they've said they want to keep them, but I think they may also be interested in kind of keeping some of their options open on what they do with that site.
There's a big if here. I mean, whether or not, of course, the Major League Baseball awards the team to Salt Lake City or not. And I guess I'm wondering if they do, would the Larry H. Miller Group, are they the ones who, Gail Miller, as you said, was the driving force behind this, would they pay for the construction of this new stadium? I know that occasionally there are, there's big public money that's funneled to the construction of stadiums. Is that, I guess that's probably yet to be seen.
Yeah, you know, it's another really kind of fascinating aspect of all of this. The Major League Baseball has tentatively floated a figure of up to $2 billion by way of fees to host this expansion. And you have to think that a stadium and sort of support facilities would be a similarly big ticket item. It is very interesting to note that this consortium, this Big League Utah, includes some of the bigger names in finance, in our market, people like the president of Zions Bank, a couple of executives from Solomir Capital, which some listeners will remember is Mitt Romney's old investment firm, now being run by his son Tag Romney, right. The roster reads like a list of including Gail Miller, of course, the wealthiest person in Utah, reads like a very kind of well-heeled list of people that could be coming up with the investment needed to pull this off also.
I have so many questions about this that are sort of speculative, waiting to see what happens. But obviously a big one that people are curious about is what might we name the team? and we don't really have answers there yet. I mean, this is everybody has ideas. I've seen them strewn across Twitter. Some people want the Trappers as a nod to our previous AAA team.
Yeah, I mean, there's a serious news thread behind that question, and that is that this is really kind of a long haul prospect. I mean, the news this week is essentially Salt Lake City's ambition to pull this off, and the original Winter Olympic bid was a long haul prospect. They worked that for almost a decade before they were successful in recruiting the games. And there's this whole question about whether Salt Lake City can kind of keep its center, keep its focus on this over what will be a long haul with Major League Baseball. But you know, this week's news is that ambition is there, and there was really palpable enthusiasm in the launch. There was a groundbreaking planned out at the Power District along North Temple that turned into the hoopla associated with trying to recruit a baseball team. And, you know, everybody from Governor Spencer Cox and Mayor Aaron Mendenhall all the way through the congressional delegation and top leadership in the legislature and lawmakers from on the city council and in the legislature on the west side are all super enthusiastic about this.
It's other things that occur to me are the Salt Lake, the bees that are being moved there. That's still going to happen from the stadium on 13th South. They are the farm team, the minor league affiliate of the Anaheim Angels. I wonder who, if we get a new team, a Major League Baseball team, who our farm team would be, who we'd be connected to. But so much to kind of ponder. Maybe George Pyle, editorial opinion editor with Tribune. I'll bring you into this. Are you excited about this prospect? What do you think about the possibility of Major League Baseball coming to Salt Lake City?
Well, I do think it's kind of thrilling. The editorial board has jumped on the bandwagon with everybody else about how this could be really exciting. I think the public policy aspect of this is the development and what's it going to do to the neighborhood. And the West Side, the mayor is behind this and the West Side council people are behind this. What you're always concerned about is this, will this be an economic driver? Will this attract ancillary businesses? Will you build hotels and restaurants and things like that nearby? The actual site would not be displacing any residents, but the West Side is already dealing with gentrification where affordable apartments and middle-class owner-occupied homes are being pushed aside for more luxury apartments. And if this leads to an increased gentrification out there, if this leads to less affordable housing in our city instead of more, then there could be some negative side effects to this. The other part of it is, are the taxpayers going to be on the hook for this? And you see different examples of this all over the country. The fact that the Millers are involved is, we think, kind of hopeful because the history of the what used to be and will again soon be called the Delta Center, where the Jazz play, the Millers paid for an awful lot of that themselves, or the business did. They borrowed the money and paid for it themselves. The city helped with infrastructure around it and floated some bonds for that. And you would hope that with the, as Tony says, the who's who of money in Utah behind this, that we don't have to expect that the taxpayers will be on the hook for this.
Okay.
It's not wholly.
That's the hope from George Pyle, who is an opinion editor with the Tribune. Tony, how long do we have to wait before we know, if this field of dreams is going to become a reality or not? When might we have some idea of that happening?
Well, I think the key to that question is going to be patience. We don't really have a timeline on when that's going to be announced. And, that raises an interesting sort of juxtaposition. My impression was that Rocky Mountain Power was moving quickly on developing that site, relatively quickly, and had a whole bunch of plans for a kind of a mixed use development there. It'll be interesting to see if they can kind of hold off until MLB's plans materialize and that site will still be available. But in answer to your question, we don't know.
All right. Jessica Miller, we're going to turn to some pretty serious investigative reporting from you after the break, but I can't leave you out of this. Are you excited for some peanuts and applejack, baseball in Salt Lake City?
I don't care at all. about this.
Jessica's not as enthusiastic as many people across the state. That's all right. That's just how it is. I love it.
How refreshing. How refreshing.
You might be the only one without an opinion.
All right. You know, that's the way that I feel about daylight savings time.
Yes.
People have huge debates about that, and I rarely...
don't care.
Yeah, it just doesn't bother me. All right. Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break in the show, our first break in the show. And when we come back, we will turn to Jessica's reporting on the secretive panels that make suing a medical provider for malpractice harder. You're listening to Behind the Headlines from Utah Public Radio, KCPW, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad, investigative reporter Jessica Miller, and opinion editor George Pyle. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments today by tweeting to @KCPW, assuming that you are still using Twitter. And if you're not, feel free to email us at news@kcpw.org. Jessica Miller, you published a report this week that was part of an investigation that you and the Tribune did in conjunction with ProPublica, and it had to do with something that I have to admit I've never heard of before, pre-litigation panels, something that the state of Utah runs. And maybe I'll just start by asking you what a pre-litigation panel is. What is that?
So it's one of the barriers that are put into place when you want to file a medical malpractice lawsuit, and this was something, you know, they put these barriers up all across the country in the 70s because there was concern that doctors were being sued, medical providers were being sued, and their insurance was going up, and therefore the cost of healthcare was rising. That cost was being passed on to us. And so the thought was, we'll make it harder to sue a medical provider if you were hurt. And one of those barriers that they've created is what's called the pre-litigation panel. It's a requirement that you go present your case to a panel that's run by the Division of Professional Licensing, DOPL. I forget what the acronym is. But you make your case to them, and you know, the doctor can also come and say, no, I didn't hurt them, or this wasn't malpractice. And the panel makes a finding whether your case has merit or not. But it's not court, and so it's not binding. So whether the panel says that your case doesn't have merit doesn't really matter, because you can go on and file your lawsuit anyways. It's literally just a procedural hoop that you have to jump through.
Wow. In fact, just to cut you off there for a second, yeah. In fact, you reported that a number of attorneys report that, you know, the panel may find that their, you know, suit doesn't have merit, but they'll take their case forward and then win.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, looking at the data, it's pretty aggregate, because the other interesting thing about this process is it's secret. The public doesn't have any access to it. When you go file your lawsuit, you can't say what the panel decided. So it doesn't help your case to say that, oh, well, the panel decided I had merit. You know, you can't disclose that so the judge can't know, a potential jury can't know. But looking at the aggregate data, only like 4% of cases are found to have merit when they're making these decisions. So, yeah, obviously we have a ton of medical malpractice cases filed every year. And so attorneys are just going on and filing the cases anyways, because, you know, they also are vetting these cases before they file them. You know, they're not interested in most aren't interested in filing frivolous lawsuits, because the attorneys are paid as part of the settlement. So they're not going to take forward a case that has no chance of winning, because that's kind of where they get their funding
yeah.
from.
Well, you wrote that many states, most, in fact, of the states used to have these malpractice screening panels with the idea of cutting back on frivolous lawsuits. But they kind of went out of favor in many of the other states around them. In fact, it went from being more than half of the states to now something like, you know, more than a dozen, but not that many more than a
dozen. There's 16 now.
16.
Yeah.
Okay. So why did they go out of favor in other places, and why is it still on the books here that we have this panel?
Well, some of them went away because legislators or the Supreme Court found that it was – they're kind of useless. Many say that they're useless. And it also has some interesting constitutional issues because, you know, according to most states' constitutions, people should have access, free access to the courts. And so by creating this barrier that delays your ability to get to the courtroom or maybe won't allow you into court, depending on the finding, was found unconstitutional in many states. So that's kind of the reason why it's kind of gone out of favor in other places. But the Utah officials that run this are pretty adamant that it does work towards its goal of cutting down frivolous lawsuits or, you know, encouraging settlements when it's necessary. But they also don't collect data to show that. So
hard to say.
It's kind of hard to say. They said that it's rare for a case that's been found to not have merit move forward. But I don't know how they know that because they don't have any data to say whether that actually happens or not.
Right. And again, you spoke to some lawyers who said, actually, no, we do move forward and win. There have been because of maybe we can get into the person that is featured in your story. You have a actually, Jessica, I'm going to scratch all of that and say that there have been some changes to the way that these panels run in recent year, especially when it comes to lawsuits that are related to sexual assault in the sort of realm of medical provision. Can you talk about about changes to this panel that are coming online pretty soon?
Yeah, it's actually a change to medical malpractice law generally. You know, when I started the reporting on this story, the project that we're doing is about sexual assault in medical settings. And, you know, I spoke with a woman whose name is Jessica Lancaster, who said that she was groped by her chiropractor. She went through this process and went in front of that panel and found it to be very re-traumatizing and said that one of the panel members asked her some pretty insensitive questions that she perceived as victim blaming for what happened to her. And so, you know, that's kind of where we started. And then by the time the story published, the legislative session happened and there was a bill that I've spoken about on this program before about that would make it exempt for sexual assault victims who've been hurt by medical providers to have to go through these medical malpractice barriers, the restrictions there. And so starting in May, no sexual assault victims who've been assaulted by healthcare providers have to go through all of these hoops that we've put in place with medical malpractice cases. We've clarified in the law that sex assault is not considered healthcare under medical malpractice, the Medical Malpractice Act. And so those people can now just go sue like an intentional tort, or like it's a different kind of lawsuit. They don't have to have the panels. They don't have to have the caps on damages that medical malpractice law provides. And there's a shorter filing deadline for medical malpractice cases, and that goes away for sex assault victims also.
Wow, a lot of changes for a specific category of crime that happens, or you know, alleged crime. I guess the this means in the future, people won't have to go through these panels when it comes to, or they won't have to get screened by these panels, which again, don't really have teeth, but they won't have to get screened in those cases. But for Jessica Lancaster, who you featured in your story, she alleges she was groped by her chiropractor, as you pointed out. She said that she was sort of re-traumatized by going in front of this panel. Her experience with going in front of this panel, though, is not done yet, right?
Well, her specifically, she's gone through the panel. So now she's filed her lawsuit that's pending. The chiropractor says that or denies her claims, but the law is not retroactive. And so it is for basically future victims, right? Anybody who's been sexually assaulted by a healthcare worker after May 3rd. So anyone who's already been harmed would still have to go through this process because, you know, you have to kind of go by the law as it was at the time that your injury occurred.
Okay, and so basically, that's a big change that's going to happen. You know, you talked about the Department of Licensing and the fact that they are sort of the group that oversees or is behind these panels. And they have defended it, saying that it does prevent frivolous lawsuits. You said that they don't have the data to back that up. I guess, like, is there a chance that these panels might, if as they have in other states, go away at some point in the future? Is that something that we know or can know? You talked about Senator Mike McKell, who ran the legislation to change the law around sexual assault that involved these panels. Is somebody else considering legislation to just do away with the panels?
Well, Senator McKell's also a personal injury attorney, and so he's very familiar with these panels and has been a chair on one of these on this panel in the past. And he thinks that they're worthless. And he wanted to run a bill a couple of years ago to get rid of them after a Supreme Court ruling here kind of narrowed what the panel's purpose could be. And he said that he heard from attorneys who wanted to keep it. And, you know, he's kind of expressed to me, like, yeah, I would get rid of it if everyone kind of got on board with it. But obviously, the medical association finds it has value. The physicians, the doctors, the healthcare workers do think that there's value in this process.
Sure.
And I think there's kind of a split among the personal injury attorney world on whether this is pointless or whether it serves a purpose.
I guess could it be seen maybe as a part of what is the kind of there's a non lawsuit related term for coming together and trying to resolve differences.
mediation.
Thank you. Yes, could that be seen as a kind of a form of mediation? You know, having parties get together at all in advance of going to court. Maybe that's a benefit. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of what the people who are advocates for this told me is obviously like it's helpful to kind of get in a room, talk to each other, see, you know, maybe you get a better understanding of what happened. But having that happen before you go to court is like it doesn't make that much sense because you don't have like subpoena power. You don't have all the records. You haven't like done depositions. You don't actually like you know what your client says happened and. But you don't have any of that documentation to back it up yet. That happens after you go to court. So it's kind of a, I don't know, it doesn't make much sense to do it that early in the case when you don't know exactly everything that happened.
It's really interesting reporting, Jessica, and we're running low on time here, but I wanted to ask, just since maybe short of doing away with the panels, are there, you talked about the change that makes those who have experienced or who say that they have experienced sexual assault, they can avoid these panels. Are there other potential changes maybe to the way they operate coming? Is that something that, you know, might be coming down the line?
You know, I've asked everyone who's kind of been critical of this, I asked, like, okay, well, how do we fix it? You know, like, do you think this is broken? What do we do? And it seemed like the answer most of the time was, like, just get rid of them. I think that we run into issues if we put more teeth in it, that it would unconstitutionally block access to the courts. And so I don't see how you could make this more rigorous without it being unconstitutional.
Wow. Well, it's fascinating reporting and points to just something that is really I'd never heard of again. And now have learned that, according to Senator McKell, it's just basically pointless. But you can check out Jessica's story at sltrib.com. George Pyle, I'm going to ask you just with our remaining moments before we head to a break again. Before we head to our underplayed stories of the week, what you think about these panels? Is it a check on this American tendency to over-litigate? Is it just a hoop to jump through that doesn't do anything? What do you think?
It kind of sounds like people who are defending them, the panels, are saying that it's a point in their favor that they're useless, they don't do any harm, so we should keep them. I think probably what we need is, as Jessica says, people keep saying they think they work, but they don't have any data. Probably ought to start accumulating data and get some idea of that. I mean, it is interesting, Senator Bill, that removed the barrier on suing for sexual abuse in a medical setting. Everybody was on board with that. The doctors were on board with that. The lawyers were on board with that. In this case, that's not what's going on, so it's probably not going to change.
All right. It's fascinating. And George, thanks for your comments on that. Jessica, I don't want to give you I don't want to cut you short. Is there anything we're missing from? I mean, there's a lot missing from this story, but we are running low on time.
I think the only thing I would add is we are continuing our reporting on sexual assault in medical settings. And so if someone has an experience in that we should be looking into, there's a form on our website. If you look at any of, if you just Google like Jessica Miller, SL Trib, you can find my staff page and any of the articles we have recently has a form that people can fill out to connect with me and share their story.
Fantastic. Again, find that at sltrib.com. You know, before we head to a break and before I let my guests go, maybe we can squeeze in some very quick underplayed stories of the week. The common feature at the end of the show here. And I'll just kick us off with the fact that there are sandbagging events happening around Salt Lake City this weekend to prepare for flooding or additional flooding. One at Sugar House Park, one at Rosewood Park. The Tribune has coverage of this along with links for signing up. You can find over at sltrip.com. Let's go over to Jessica Miller, a pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to pick a story that Emily Anderson Stern did about a legislative audit of the Utah State Prison and the way they're doing medical services. They were audited in 2021 very harshly, and it turns out they are doing worse than they did in 2021. They're not improving. They are giving worse health care for prisoners. It's a really interesting and infuriating read.
Okay, check that out, sltrip.com. George Pyle, a quick pick for underplayed story.
Our colleague Brian Schott has the scoop this morning on House Speaker Brad Wilson is putting together a committee, apparently, to challenge Mitt Romney for his reelection bid, which is something that 6 years ago, I think maybe nobody thought would happen.
Yeah. It's an interesting race possibly coming up in 2024. Thanks for that pick, George. And Tony Semerad, quick pick from you as well.
Yeah, I usually don't highlight my own stories, but the Salt Lake City Planning Commission rejected a gas station that was proposed right on the border with Sugar House Park, much to some people's surprise and to the comfort of the community, which had opposed the project.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, George. Thank you, Jessica, all with Salt Lake Tribune. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Yep. Now on the show, we are going to turn to a conversation that I had yesterday with Andy Larson about a few items, but to begin with, his analysis as a data columnist into the reasons behind our snowier than usual winter. Andy Larson, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
Of course. There's a couple of things that I want to explore with you, Andy, and maybe we can start where all small talk starts, which is with the weather. And we've got spring that is finally springing here in northern Utah with trees that are budding and bulbs and birdsong and all the rest of it. But just barely over a week ago, we still seem to be in the throes of deep winter. And this past weekend, you wrote about our amazing, and I mean really amazing, season of snowfall here in northern Utah. And in Utah in general. And in that article, you tried to delve into why we had so much snow this winter compared with recent winters. And you explored scientific and not so scientific reasons for this bounty of snow. Can we talk a little bit just about how unusual, how big this this winter was, Andy? What do the numbers show there? How do we know that it was a big winter other than the fact that we just saw tons of snow?
Yeah, I mean, look, the in terms of estimated water pack at all of our various different water and snow measurement stations, this was a new record high. Obviously, we saw some record highs at our ski resorts in terms of snow. Alta reached 874 inches of total snowfall. Wow. They had roughly 20 feet on the ground at any given time. So that was pretty crazy. But yeah, the snow water equivalent has reached 30 inches on average at these measurement stations. And those have kind of changed over the years. So it's not exactly apples to apples, but it's pretty close. And it's the first time on record we've seen 30 inches of average snow water equivalent at those stations.
First time on record. I mean, I don't remember experiencing anything like it since I was a kid. And even when I was a kid, I don't know if it got to the levels that we saw this past winter. Well, let's dive into the science, which at least in part has this kind of unsatisfying answer, you write. And that unsatisfying answer is randomness, although that's not the end of the story.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that it's not really randomness that leads to the amount of snow and crazy winters and changes in the weather from day to day. But it's one of those things that's such a complex, chaotic system, our weather patterns, and especially over the course of multiple weeks, multiple months, that it might as well be, you know, and it's one of those things, you know, like if you could model a coin flip, you know, if you could measure the exact vector of force your thumb puts on the coin and the direct exact location of the coin, and you modeled the exact specifications of the coin you were flipping and knew the air resistance and you know, changes and whatever else in whatever coin you were flipping, the atmosphere, if you will, you could model, you know, whether or not a coin was going to be heads or tails with good accuracy. It's kind of like that, where there's just so much complexity in kind of the atmospheric patterns in our air movement and et cetera, that we can't model the fluid flow dynamics more than, you know, really a week, 10 days out with a whole lot of confidence. And so, you know, we can use kind of longer term climatological conditions as maybe hints towards what kind of spring or summer or winter or fall we're going to get, you know, in terms of a specific season. But even those are just so probabilistic. We're talking about, hey, maybe the dice are loaded to be maybe a 60% chance of having a drier than normal winter versus a 40% chance of a wetter than normal winter. You know, we just really don't have very much clarity or accuracy in these forecasts, again, more than a couple weeks out.
You know, you wrote that just for in terms of this past winter in particular, there is something that did play a role, and that people, I guess, maybe in retrospect are able to say, yeah, this was part of the sauce that created this amazing winter. And that was La Niña, which is, it has to do with water temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. Can you talk about that and how it did play a role, maybe?
Yeah, so, you know, because those air currents and kind of our atmospheric conditions are so constantly changing, so fluid, again, that fluid flow dynamics that are really hard to model, the one thing that kind of does last a little bit longer is oceanic temperatures, you know, really the water temperatures, whether they're cool or hot in different parts of the world, is a little bit more stable. And so, you know, because we know that weather systems come from these oceanic evaporation, we can figure out, you know, what things tend to look like. And in particular, in the last couple of years, we've been in a La Niña cycle, which means that the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean near the equator is cooler than normal by, like, you know, 6 degrees or so. So what we see then is usually when that happens, you see drier southwest conditions in the southwestern United States and wetter conditions in the northwest United States. And in fact, that's not really what we saw in this winter, which is kind of interesting, right? Like, so again, kind of the climatological forecast of this winter when they made it in October for November through February, it said that Utah was kind of in the middle of this wet and dry zone, and that really there was about a 50-50 chance on whether this winter would be wetter than normal or drier than normal. What ended up happening is that La Niña receded a little bit and moved the high pressure zone that you might expect with the La Niña further west, which kind of allowed more of the colder air from the north to kind of settle in where Utah was. Now, it's funny because you read climate.org's, you know, the U.S. Climatological Association's, their wrap up of their forecast, kind of their self-evaluation of how they did. And they're like, look, our climate forecast was pretty great, you know, because we were able to accurately forecast, hey, there was a high pressure location here and a low pressure location here. It was just only 1,000 miles off of where we thought it would be, which on a global, you know, setting is not very many miles. But for us citizens of Utah, it's a whole lot, right? Like it matters a ton whether or not that the high pressure zone is 1,000 miles here or there. So, you know, for us in particular, and really most of the Western United States, that forecast was significantly incorrect. And again, you kind of look at how difficult it is to model climatological conditions moving forward as a result of that. La Niña, by the way, officially ended in March 2023. So now we're in the neutral zone in terms of where those water temperatures are. And that means that kind of that forecast no longer, you know, applies moving forward.
Yeah. Although given the sort of unpredictability of the global climatic system and all the rest of it that you're describing, whether or not the fact that doesn't apply, I don't even know if that means all that much to me right now, Andy. I guess. Yeah.
I mean, it really is like, again, a loading of the dice kind of thing, but in a very, very small way where, you know, you look at these climatological forecasts and it's like, well, you know, even when we have the most surety, you know, it's talking about like Montana has a 70% chance of being wetter than normal over the course of 3 or 4 months, you know, and really when you're looking at individual winters overall, it's hard to tell whether or not, you know, those forecasts were accurate or, you know, there was randomness at play, what have you, in kind of these kind of short term, how do you, I guess, middle term, how do you figure out what a season will look like ahead of time? But I think it's fair to say that most climatologists were really surprised about what happened this winter in the Western United States.
The thing that occurs to me here is that, you know, we're talking about, you know, this predicting the weather and predicting like a season of potential snowfall. And then there are the changes at the whole system, you know, at the global scale that are happening. And I'm wondering how, is there anything to be said about what this means or doesn't mean about the future of our winters, the fact that we had this big winter last winter?
Yeah, it's interesting. There have been some Utah State studies that kind of indicate that essentially you have these wet and dry cycles in the Intermountain West. And so it could be that this is a start of a wetter cycle. Again, it could be that this is just an anomaly that has no bearing on whether or not this will happen moving forward. I do think that there are a couple of interesting scientific studies that I referenced in this article that do apply to a kind of changing climate overall. You know, first, Simon Wang at Utah State University collaborated on this study about the what's called the warm Arctic cold continent weather pattern or weather theory. And maybe it's more of a hypothesis, but really, we found that, as you know, I think most of your listeners know, the globe is warming, but especially in the Arctic and Antarctic caps, right, in the polar zone. And because of that, you know, it's actually warming more in those locations than the rest of the world. That may have a unexpected effect on how air currents and kind of global atmosphere currents, you know, the jet stream, the atmospheric rivers you may hear about, et cetera, flow differently given that different heat pattern in the Earth's poles in ways we didn't expect. They have some kind of fluid dynamic modeling that shows that, heck, yes, you know, essentially that it moves the jet stream to such an extent that you end up with a colder kind of mid-latitude continent weather during these winters in North America and Northern Eurasia, where, again, kind of across these middle latitudes where Utah is. whether or not that's, you know, it's actually kind of a debated theory among climatologists as whether or not this is overreacting to the last few winters we've had, where we have seen colder winters than expected at the continent level while we have these warmer ice caps, or if this is kind of a real fluid dynamics phenomenon that we should expect moving forward. That's kind of what that study addresses.
Well, it seems like the stability of predictability is, I mean, like maybe as the poles warm, that pushes, you know, warming into other places and cooling into other places. And then you have to, you know, remodel based on the new conditions that exist and then remodel again and remodel again. And to the extent that it seems like it's a protean thing, you're never going to be able to land on a solid answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you read climatologists from all over the world, and you know, kind of the old models that you may have used are changing, you know, and are changing in kind of unexpected ways. And so, you know, as you build these models, you know, do you use multiple decades of evidence? You know, do you look at 1950 to 2010, or do you take into account more strongly the 2010 through 2020 era, where again we're starting to see real, you know, global changes and global warming and those kind of things, right? So that's a difficult question for any modeler to ever answer, you know, with future looking forecasts. And certainly that applies with weather and climate data as well.
Well, okay, so that's, we've been talking a lot about the science, but your article also, Andy, I can't leave this aside, it delved into a different realm, the spiritual realm, for explanations as to why our winter was as amazing as it was, or as snow-filled as it was. And first, you talked about Governor Spencer Cox asking people to pray for snow, which is something that his predecessor, Governor Gary Herbert, had also done. And you wrote that there have been inconclusive studies on the power of prayer.
Yeah, you know, this was definitely a more of a side part of this article than anything, but I couldn't get out of this article without mentioning the two groups that want to seek some credit for this winter, right? And I think one of them is, yeah, kind of the Spencer Cox, Gary Herbert, you know, prayer for weather to change and you may see a change kind of point of view. Spencer Cox first asked Utahns to pray for this 2 years ago, renewed that prayer ask this winter. And, you know, obviously some people in that realm have wanted to take credit for, yeah, this remarkable winter that we see. Interestingly, there are like some legitimate scientific studies on the power of prayer, especially in health constructs. And, you know, to what extent Is prayer a helpful thing from either a placebo effect point of view or a, you know, emotional support point of view? Interestingly, there are a wide variety of studies that have shown in some circumstances that kind of thing is very helpful. There are even a couple of studies where, you know, there have been certainly multiple studies where it had a neutral or non-existent effect. And then I think there are even a couple of studies, one with regards to even heart condition, heart failure, that show that prayer had a negative effect when people prayed for this thing to happen. Hmm. So, you know, it's kind of all over the spectrum. And this meta-analysis that I looked at, which is, again, totally, you know, a perfect example of how I like do my research, is that, you know, we've got like this meta-analysis on the efficacy of prayer, but we weren't able to decide when prayer worked consistently in health conditions versus when it didn't. Likewise, we don't have a whole lot of evidence on when prayer is effective for weather. And then, of course, I would be ashamed to not note the whale and its recent building, the Ninth and Ninth Whale. And I think the All Hail the Whale group has grown here in Salt Lake. And, you know, heck, if the whale is bringing wintry conditions to Salt Lake, that's certainly possible. But again, I was unable to find scientific evidence of such a theory.
I mean, it was a whale of a winter. I have to read the conclusion to your piece. I thought it ended pretty hilariously. It says, while an article this week quoted David Amaral, a Sugar House resident, as jokingly saying, it's 100% the whale, and it's been scientifically proven, no such scientific study could be found on the influence of whale statues on local climates. I thought that was great, Andy. And maybe a little bit of confirmation bias on all sides, I think, here, maybe.
To the extent that we can fund a whale statue study on weather and climate change, I'm all for that.
Okay. A new mythology emerging around the whale, the worship of the whale statue in the Ninth and Ninth neighborhood. And Andy Larson's going to try and get some government funding to study that, I think. Andy, just speaking of, before we go, speaking of weird seasons, I'm wondering if we can turn to your regular beat for just a little while. And you cover the Utah Jazz on a normal day-to-day basis. And they have also had a whale of a season themselves, succeeding in unexpected ways, but not making the playoffs. I don't think we're going to have a lot of time for this. Maybe we should actually revisit something that we talked about when the season started, Andy, which is that the idea that the Jazz, or maybe the Jazz front office or somebody in the Jazz organization, might not have wanted to be all that good. Remind us of why that was lurking in the background.
Yeah, you know, essentially the NBA's incentives are such that there's the NBA draft in the offseason, and one of the best ways to get good young talent in your team is through the NBA draft. It's probably the major way. And the worse you are the previous season, the higher odds you have of getting a higher selection in that draft and, you know, potentially getting a better player moving forward. And so because this draft especially is a very talented draft, it has one of the best prospects we've ever seen in basketball history. And this French guy, Victor Wembanyama, who's 7'2", combines some of the best aspects of Rudy Gobert and Kevin Durant. You know, there's a argument to be made that if you want that kind of star level player to play here in Utah, the best way to make that happen is to lose those games, to lose enough games that you have the best odds in order to get him. As it turned out, the Jazz were neither terrible enough to have excellent odds at a number one pick, nor good enough to make the playoffs. Instead, they're kind of in between. They have a 4.5% chance as it stands at that number one pick, about a 20% chance at a top four pick, which would, you know, give them a player that's kind of projected to be an all-star moving forward. But yeah, you know, and yet despite that, I think there were a number of really good things in this season that bring some promise to Jazz fans moving forward. Emergence of Lauri Markkanen, the emergence of Walker Kessler, two really young players who just really exceeded expectations this year and are definite building blocks for the path forward to come. So
yeah, and there was a lot of, I mean, the team played a lot of bench players rather than starters. There was maybe a little bit of an effort to try and I hate to say the word tank, but on the idea of tanking for better draft picks, the way that you described, I kind of find it. I mean, I can't help but think of the movie Eight Men Out about the Chicago White Sox, dubbed the Black Sox, and the great shame that they, you know, the nation cast upon them for throwing games. I mean, how is it that we're in a point in professional sports where tanking isn't shameful?
Yeah, you know, I think there's real debate about that, you know, and when is it best for your fans to have a longer term approach versus a short term approach? Or should we just be, you know, competing to the fullest extent that we can all the time? You know, I think essentially what has happened over the last century and is sports have gotten to become bigger and bigger business. And, you know, players and are seen as assets. At the NBA level, you know, really the way that the league's collective bargaining agreement works with the players' union, teams are really guaranteed, financial success to some degree. There's revenue sharing between the biggest markets and the smallest markets to make sure that no one kind of gets left behind. And with franchise values going up so much year after year, so, you know, the Jazz being recently sold for $1.6 billion, you really see how valuable kind of these assets are and, you know, players being worth hundreds of millions of dollars. There's just a lot more mathematical long-term thinking that's going into that process that leads to kind of these short-term decisions where, yeah, it's, you know, probably best in the long-term to lose, which, you know, I don't think people were thinking about back in the 19 teens when the Black Sox and everything was a thing. So, it's just wild how much has changed. And I think it's one of those things where the organizers of those leagues, the league's commissioners, the team owners, and, you know, the leaders of the Players Association can do more to, change the incentives there so that long-term success more often lies with short-term effort and short-term trying their hardest. Because right now there are these like really weird contrasting incentives that lead to, I think, a weird taste in a lot of people's mouths.
Yeah, I just want to see people play their hardest basketball. I want to see real basketball played. And I find it a little bit appalling. All right, last question for you, Andy. Your colleague Aaron Falk reported on the fact that there's a bid to try and bring a Major League Baseball team here to Salt Lake City, Utah. What do you want the team to be named? If it happens.
Love to see a return to kind of Salt Lake's baseball history. So, you know, the Salt Lake Gulls is kind of what I'm hoping for.
I love it.
The Trappers would be great. And, you know, heck, if they just give them the Bees name, I wouldn't hate that either. But I'm, kind of looking for something with a tie to Utah and its baseball history without being maybe a little bit too corny.
All right, Andy Larson, Utah Jazz beat reporter and other things at the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us, as always, and great to talk to you again.
Thanks again.
Andy's reporting on sports, mostly, and weather and other things can be found over at sltrib.com, which is also where you can find all of the coverage that we've been discussing on the show today. That is it for Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. It was great to be back as a guest host today and hope to do it again soon. Thanks to Tom Williams for sharing the microphone. He will be back next week, by the way. Have a great weekend, and thanks once more for tuning in.